You're listening to episode 15 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this episode, we talk with Shane Ivey of Arc Dream Publishing. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is Pat.
And this is Chris.
And joining us today is Shane Ivey. We don't normally do announcements on the interview shows, but there's one in particular I want to give because it's a fairly timely one, which is while we were doing the pre-con tourism, a couple of guys asked if I would take them to a local gaming store. And so I took them by a local chain called the Fantasy Shop, particularly to the location that's in St. Charles. And while I was there, I learned that they have a game day coming up I wanted to let anyone who's local know about. So if you're in this area and would like to stop by, it's going to be at the West Clay St. Charles location of the Fantasy Shop. And I'll link to this in the show notes. And basically what it is $15 for a 12 p.m. to 11 p.m. game day. What they're going to do is they are going to have stacks and stacks and stacks of board games where basically people can come in, play these board games, learn a little bit about them. And then they're also going to be doing door prizes and raffles and all kinds of other stuff. And on top of that, each participant that shows up will also get a coupon for a couple bucks off of any product in the shop. So if you're in the area and looking for a board game day where you can either just throw some dice or possibly even try out some new titles to see if you want to buy, then that's something you'll want to be sure to check out. Shane, we're going to start this the way we always do these interviews, and I want you to go ahead and tell the audience, for anyone that's not familiar with your work, what exactly it is you do.
Okay. I run Arc Dream Publishing, which is a partnership between me and Dennis Detwiller. We publish and design games such as Wild Talents, Monsters That Are...
You're not worried about the financial implications of getting into business with a man named Detwiller?
Oh, he just writes and draws stuff.
Go on, so, no, I'm sorry.
Wild Talents, Monsters of the Childish Things. We've designed and put together and spearheaded the last couple of Delta Green books in conjunction with Pagan Publishing. And Godlike is a World War II role-playing game that was sort of our first big thing. It was originally published by a different company that we both worked with. And then we launched Arc Dream to sort of take it on.
And it's my understanding Wild Talents is essentially a, if not a system sequel, at least a spiritual sequel of Godlike.
Yeah, absolutely. The games wind up playing kind of differently because the rules evolved a lot in between Godlike and this edition of Wild Talents. But yeah, originally Wild Talents came about because Godlike, it was doing pretty well and it had a good bit of heat behind it after the first couple of years after it came out. And there were a lot of people that really enjoyed the way it played and the way that superpowers worked in it. And it has superpowers, by the way. And, they really liked the tone of it, which is very, very different from most superhero games. But a lot of people were really eager to see it played in other settings than World War II. So Wild Talents originally was basically, okay, we'll take what makes Godlike tick and then add a bunch of guidelines for tweaking and adapting that to different settings and different play styles. So if you want to dial it back, you know, so that the violence isn't quite as deadly and gruesome as it is in Godlike, then you can do that. Or if you want to have it a little more four color, then you can do that. The rules just kind of evolved and got a little bit more complex and detailed as we went for, especially with superpowers, because our goal was to make it a game that you could fit into any idea, into any setting. So it kind of reverse engineered a lot of the stuff that was in Godlike so that you can re-engineer it to do what you want it to do.
Where I'd like to start this conversation, there was a discussion that you and I had this past year at Gen Con. I sat by your booth a couple times. One of the things that we kicked around that has really stuck with me since then, and actually, Chad, you saw this yourself and by coincidence had the same conversation with me, is with a role-playing game, the real selling point of a game, the point where somebody's going to love or hate it, is the experience of playing it. But the problem is that when you're walking through a game store, all you have is a cover or maybe a back-of-the-book blurb by which to try and sell this. Or if you're trying to explain to somebody in passing, you have to give them this elevator pitch of what it is like to play the game. And with some games, they might have enough in common with another game that that's fairly easy to do. You can say, well, this is just like D&D, but a little more realistic, or you describe Savage Worlds as this is a quick play pulp game that fits in a variety of settings really easily. But then there are games like Monsters and Other Childish Things where the elevator pitch is awkward at best.
Yeah.
And Chad, you had made this comment to me right after playing it at Fear the Con, something to the effect of, you know, hearing the elevator pitch, you weren't too sure about it, but you played it and loved it.
Yeah, it was a great game.
And Shane, we were talking about the difficulty of selling that specific game or any game like it when there's no easy elevator pitch. And I'm curious how you've wrestled with that over the years and what sort of approaches you've come up with to try and get past that.
Yeah, it's tricky. And that's one of the trickiest things that we deal with, you know, with Monsters especially, but with a lot of games, even with Godlike, for instance, it's kind of hard to convey what makes it different, you know. So I can kind of do the Hollywood, you know, it's X meets Y thing, and that'll get you some of the distance, but it won't really sell the game. Conceptually, with Monsters, for instance, I always tell people in person that it's kind of like Call of Cthulhu meets Calvin and Hobbes. And so that works, but that we can't put that on the back of the book, though, because those are both trademarks, you know, and we'd get sued. So usually if I'm in person with somebody and they laugh at that and it sparks their imagination, that's usually a pretty good sign that they'll get a kick out of it when they try it. But like I said, that only goes so far. It's definitely a tough challenge, and it's one that we haven't really quite figured out 100% yet. I've worked really hard on putting together the back of the book text for the core rule book to make it evocative and give some kind of idea of what was going to happen in the game. But the bottom line is a game like that has a very specific kind of concept behind it and a very specific sort of sense of humor. And that's something that's really hard to convey without just sitting down and playing it, you know, or walking somebody through it.
Shane, what have you tried and what have you seen, you know, the results from those? You mentioned Godlike, and this may have been before you guys kind of took it over, but I remember there were ads or there was like brief 2 or 3 page comics in old issues of Dragon before it went out of print. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, it was in Polyhedron and Dungeon, right.
Yes. Okay, because I remember seeing it was black and white art, and it did actually, the artwork itself did kind of spark my interest. But you saying, you know, that you hadn't had that much success with it, you know, kind of brought that home for me because, you know, I looked at it and it was very interesting and the title was somewhat intriguing, but I couldn't quite piece together what I was seeing and then what I was reading, you know, for the title.
Yeah.
And so I'm very curious as to what you have tried.
Yeah, and that doesn't really tell you what you're going to be doing playing the game. Reading a narrative or even short fiction, you know, fluff fiction or whatever in the book, that itself doesn't tell you how the game is actually going to play. It might tell you how the writer wants it to play, but those are sometimes two really different things. And so what we do is we encourage actual play reports. And every time I hear of one, you know, I try to make a point of singing it to the heavens and putting links all over the place, you know, to encourage people to read it. You know, I've written a lot of really detailed actual play reports myself, not just for my own games. On RPG.net, I've posted some AP reports on Aces and Eights and Duty and Honor, a couple of historical games, just because I wanted to kind of convey a sense of what the action was like. And then I would add little notes about how the rules worked, you know, in parentheticals. And so that's sort of the biggest thing. You know, one thing that we haven't tried really is video. You know, YouTube is up there and there's nothing really to stop us from videotaping a game in session to sort of give some idea of it, except that, you know, that takes some technical expertise and a lot of time that I don't have certainly. Yeah. And it's hard to.
In most gaming sessions, like even at a con game, is minimum 3 hours.
Well, and right, yeah, you'd have to just be playing something really short. And the uncomfortable fact is watching other people play a role playing game is really awkward and stupid.
That's the part I was going to question. Yeah. Is I've seen, for example, we're part of the Pulp Gamer network of shows, and the guys are at Pulp Gamer, I believe, with Mayfair, do this thing called the White Glove series, where they have a little white glove that shows you how to play a board game in 5 or 10 minutes. With a board game that works, because right. there's a lot of visual elements to it. There's pieces. You see it in play.
And it's not actually videotaping people playing the game.
Yeah.
It's demonstrating.
With a role-playing game, man, it is awkward at best, quite frankly, at times to even listen to, much less watch. I mean, it's just people sitting there.
It's
just
not a spectator sport.
The thing is, this isn't unique to my games, though. I mean, if you're talking to somebody who doesn't have a clue about role playing and you try to tell them what was super cool about the D&D game you were in the night before, that's really awkward to do. Unless they are willing to buy into it somehow for other reasons, you know, they've heard about it. Or you can say, oh, well, it's just like playing World of Warcraft, except it's with people and dice instead of the screen. But, you know, back in the good old days when RPG just meant tabletop role-playing game, it's always been the thing, is the way that you bring people on board is by getting them to sit down and play, you know, and if it clicks with them, it clicks. If it doesn't, then it doesn't.
So in that case, have you made efforts to get these games out at cons, get people playing them? Because I know my first introduction to Wild Talents was Ross Payton from Role Playing Public Radio running a game at Fear the Con. Chad played Monsters and Other Childish Things because he came and run it. I know that
you owe him kickbacks, by the way, if you're not giving them to him already.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know he's actually one of your writers. And from talking, actually emailing back and forth with you guys right before the con, I know that you do make some effort to get people to run these at the con.
I would love to see 100 times more people running with the con. And when setting up some kind of official organized thing, you know, where we recruit people and we give them prizes and awards and pats on the back. And that, I mean, that's something that I've tried to do in fits and starts over the years and always kind of run into the problem of not enough time to run it. I've actually talked with Ross about seeing if I could rope him into being sort of the community boss or whatever you want to call it, but we haven't finalized that yet either. But it's tough because, you know, we're small. I mean, Arc Dream is basically, you know, it's me in the daytime before I go to my night job, and then it's what time Dennis can put into it, and then a lot of freelancers whose availability comes and goes, you know. So for a small company, it's really tricky to make any of that kind of stuff stick, and to stick with it for any length of time.
Well, and to quote Jim Davis, this may be looking for the bright side of a train wreck, but I really have to think that in some way the issue you're up against actually might help you. And here's why I say that. We ourselves have had experiences, and we've talked to a lot of other people who've had experiences, where you pick up a particular, I don't know, let's say a novel, and you really like that work of fiction. But then you meet the author, and the author's a really nice guy. You have an interaction with them, and now suddenly you are invested in something you already loved in a way that you never would have been invested had it not been for breaking down that fourth wall and suddenly getting a look at the people that actually make what you enjoy occur. And in your case, Shane, I mean, don't get me wrong, I've met some jackasses in the role-playing industry, but you're not one of them. You know, you're a very easy guy to get along with, you know, as is Ross and whatnot. And so I would almost think that in some way, while you may have to work harder to sell the game, when you make that sale, because of the path you had to follow to get there, you have made not just a fan, you have made a follower, I mean, so to speak.
That's definitely what we shoot for. You know, I mean, saying it's deliberate may sound a little Machiavellian, but it shouldn't, you know, because we long ago realized that our strength was not going to be in massive marketing budgets, because we write games that don't have a really massive appeal. What they do have is a fairly deep appeal with the people that like them. So, you know, we've always sort of tried to find our sweet spot in accepting that we don't have a massive following, but staying engaged with the ones that are there, you know, and the gamers that are coming back and that are really interested in having a great time with what we do. So from the very beginning, we've always been very accessible, been available by email on a daily basis on our dedicated mailing lists and message boards and Facebook, once Facebook was out there, and you know, so that we could sort of respond to questions. And you know, anybody that wants to hear anything about or has a question about the Wild Talents rules, and there have been plenty of them, can get an answer from either me or Dennis or Greg Stoltze, usually within a few hours, if not that, then within a day or so. You know, so we've always stayed really engaged, partly because it's fun and because not making a ton of money, one of the benefits of doing this is having our ego stroked by dealing with people that like us. But,
and that was actually going to be my question in regards to that, is what kind of reaction do you get? Like, you know, you talk about really the size of Arc Dream, you know, which admittedly is very small. But yet, from the player's perspective, when they go and they pick up that game at the store, they still have that perception that it's made by a big company, or at least something bigger than what they're used to. And, and of course, you know, we all know what the reality is. But when they once they start interacting with you and see that level of accessibility, how does that change their interaction with you? How do they treat you at that point?
Oh, well, usually it's very cool. And it's interesting. I mean, we started Arc Dream in late 2002, even though that's still in the 2000s. The internet has evolved a lot even since then. They didn't have podcasts when we started Arc Dream. So from the very beginning, it was always really, really fun. In all the time that I've been involved professionally with gaming, you know, which has been about 15 years now, I've had maybe two interactions that were really sour with people that weren't professionals doing things to irritate me, but were just, you know, gamers. For the most part, it's really fun. I mean, and people are really, really cool. Like I said, I mean, we put a lot of work into the games that we make. And so that pays off in the response that we usually get to them, you know, because like I said, the people that like what we do, you know, if we keep doing it really well, then they tend to respond to that and be really interested in it and engaged with it. That's not to say every one of our things has been a runaway, you know, anything, but more often than not, we get a really good response from the fans, and they tend to be very open. And sometimes even they step in and answer rules questions and free me up to keep doing other stuff.
So on the other side of that, how are the other indie publishers? I've been kind of curious about this. You know, all the companies are these smaller companies, a couple of guys up to, say, 15 guys or so. You've been around for quite a while. Is this a supportive community? Is it cutthroat? How do you interact with these people?
Oh, it's totally supportive. There's really very, very little sense of competition between us and other publishers out there. And in part, that's because in the indie community, everybody is doing such different things. The whole point of it has always been to let the designers do something that just really sharply tailors to what they are interested in, what they want to see. So that means that if you're looking to play Mouse Guard, you're not going to be interested in Godlike anyway. So we generally don't have to worry too much about whether somebody's going to choose Mouse Guard over Godlike or over Wild Talents, because they're such really different things. So yeah, I mean, the smaller publishers overwhelmingly are very accessible with each other. You know, there's a lot of communication, a lot of back and forth, and that's really fun. It's kind of funny, though, because the higher up in the food chain you go, the less accessible they tend to be. If you're getting up to the top two or three tiers of role-playing publishers, the guys that are really making money, you know, and can do it for a living, for whatever reasons, they're the ones that you don't hear from much in the sort of industry chatter. And I think that's for different reasons for different companies, but that's sort of the consistent end result. From my perspective, anyway, Paizo has been kind of the exception to that, because they've always been really active at staying in touch with people and with their audience. But a lot of the other companies, the bigger guys, I think they tend to either have their hands full, or they may have their hands tied by corporate obligations. They have to be kind of careful what they say and do. But when you get down deeper into the pond, everybody's friends, and it's a really interesting kind of cool community.
We found a similar problem with us in the podcast world. It's gotten very difficult because we move so high up on the food chain to interact with, you know, interact with a great unwashed, and you know, correspond with him.
We're a bunch of inaccessible area jackasses now.
Yeah, well, I am building an ivory tower in my backyard.
Oh, so. Yeah, absolutely.
We were only willing to hang out with them for a week when they came to our con. I mean,
that's what I'm shooting for, but I haven't hit that dream yet.
There was something I wanted to ask you about to see if you guys are doing it. If not, I guess to challenge you to do it, because I have to think you might benefit from it, at least in a little way. Wayne wanted to ask you about Bits and Mortar, and this is going to tie right into it, because I remember back when my brother was still playing 40K, he used to have a very simple way of selling the game to people, which was like a drug dealer. The first one was always free. So if you so much as looked at the game, he would go out and buy you a squad or a tank or whatever on his own dime and show you what you could do with it and thereby hook you into the game. Now, as I was cleaning out the studio room here a couple days ago, I was digging around and I found a pre-release pamphlet from White Wolf's Hunter: The Vigil, which gave you sort of a little sampling in the course of a couple pages of what the game was like to play. So it sort of immersed you in the game without actually giving you the product. And I'm curious, because I know that you guys are active in the electronic and PDF market, which we'll get to in more detail when we get to Bits and Mortar. But I'm curious, have you guys considered putting out for free a pamphlet where someone who's kind of piqued by, let's say, monsters and other childish things, but doesn't really get it, could have a 5 or 10 page mini game, mini adventure to sell them on the concept, after which they can have that aha moment and then turn around and buy the full product?
Right. We haven't done that anywhere near as much as we should. We have something like that for Godlike, that's a character guide that sort of walks you through what the game is all about and how to create a character from start to finish. And, you know, it doesn't have all the detailed descriptions of what the various powers do and weapons and that stuff, but it gives you enough to fill out a character sheet and have a sense of it. And we did something like that for a Wild Talents setting called the Kerberos Club that we did a year or two ago and that we've kind of expanded on a couple of times since then, where we did a quick play booklet for that that's about, I don't know, it's actually pretty solid. I think it's 24 pages all told. It gives sort of an abbreviated history of the setting and a lot of stuff to give you a sense of what play is meant to be all about, and then some really detailed pre-generated characters that each kind of illustrate different aspects of what the game setting is like and what gameplay is like for that setting. And then for monsters, you know, I actually did a two-page front and back sheet that we've handed out at every convention since the game first came out that I'm pretty sure is online, but it's something that I really ought to put out there on RPG Now as a free download. And there's lots of things like that that I keep meaning to do and haven't, and I really have no excuse for it other than ineptness.
Hey, I've been there.
Well, hey man, you got in your case, a night job.
Yeah.
It's called life.
Yeah.
So what about Free RPG Day? That seems like a good place to get some of this stuff out.
Yeah, but it's not free for me is the problem.
Yeah, I've actually looked into it wondering, you know, how cool would it be if we could have a Fear the Boot CD in every game store for Free RPG Day? And I saw just the quantities you have to give to get in those boxes.
I'd say a buck or two per CD to print. I've checked the prices however many thousands that's going to be. But it would seem like, you know, if you made something like a PDF and you get people out there who are your really hardcore fans, your evangelizing fans, and they could turn around and at very little or no cost to themselves say, look, I can't get you the full source book, but here, let me just forward you a link. Download this, try this out with your friends. You know, it's a one-shot adventure or whatever. And now suddenly they've got a foot in the pond. Now suddenly
That's definitely something I want to do more of. That's something that pays off in a huge way. Like I said, the little monsters thing that I put together, it's only two pages, and it has sort of a summary of what the rules are like, you know, but it's not that you can really play from, but it's enough to kind of give you an idea of what the sense of humor is like and what the action tends to revolve around and it tells you the game is about monsters that can do crazy, horrible things, but it's also more about building relationships and having them threatened and the importance of protecting them. That's always been a fairly successful thing. And yeah, I need to put more of them out there.
So speaking of digital releases, for years I've gone on now that role-playing companies, even I'd like to see regular publishers do this. If you buy a physical copy of the book, I think you should get a digital copy of that book. It's something that if you're already producing it, it's an extra bonus. It makes me more likely to buy the book. And then I hear that you're part of a group of companies that are actually doing this.
Yes, Bits and Mortar. Could you tell us about Bits and Mortar?
Sure, yeah. Well, we've been doing exactly that for years now with almost all of our products. And the only games, you know, that we have not done that with in the last several years were either properties that contractually we didn't have electronic publishing rights to, or books that were so old that we didn't have the right layout files to put together a PDF. And so everything else, we decided a long time ago that if we're making it available in PDF format, then we'd just make it available as a freebie if you buy it in print. It's one more thing to encourage people to pony up the money and buy the game. Because as you say, once they've bought the book, why not let them have the PDF as well? And well, I mean, that's kind of a dumb way to put it, because a lot of companies don't. And the reason why not is because some of them are going to buy the PDF and then you have 10 extra dollars instead of zero. But from my perspective, we've always earned a lot of goodwill from making those PDFs available and encouraging people to use them. Even if that means we'd sell fewer of the PDF by itself, it gets the game in front of other people who may be really interested in it. So Bits and Mortar came about because there were several publishers doing exactly that. And we kind of all had the same idea, or whoever had it first, you know, and then we all said, hey, you know what? He's onto something. Let's try that. You know, and there were a number of us who wound up doing the same thing. And we decided that what we ought to do is try to organize in some way, and in some way that would kind of get the word out that a number of us are doing this, and also do something that will make the physical game stores more comfortable with the notion of PDF publishing. Because a lot of game stores, they look at PDF sales as money out of their cash registers. If you buy Wild Talents in PDF, then what need do you have to come to my store and buy a copy in print?
Sure, the death of Blockbuster was Netflix and streaming videos.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, they have a point. And so we feel like it's short-sighted. Everything that we've kind of seen in the publishing world points to the availability of PDFs as boosting awareness of the print book and boosting sales of it, because you have a lot of people that will get a PDF out of curiosity, even if they're just downloading it illegally and sneakily without paying anything for it. And if they like what they read, it's much more convenient to have a 300-page game book in your hand to thumb through it than it is to, you know, hit page, 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 time after time to try to find what you're looking for. So there were a lot of us that wanted to kind of communicate to game stores that we weren't doing this to screw them. We're doing this because we're on their side. And here's something we can offer your customers to make them want to buy something from you. And so the way that works is if a store signs up at bitsandmortar.com, and there are little dashes in between the words there, but if they sign up at the website, then the store... gets a username and a password, and they have access to the PDF files for all of the titles that are available under this program for all these different publishers. And so anytime somebody comes up to the counter and buys the book, then you can take their email address and enter it into the system and have Bits and Mortar just email them a link to the download. Or if you want to do it yourself, the game store is welcome to just download the files onto their own computers and put them on little thumb drives or email them to the customers on their own or whatever. The whole point of it is to kind of encourage the stores to get involved and to not worry about having us always trying to snoop on what they're doing with the files. You know, so they're not watermarked. They don't have security settings or anything like that on there. We want to make it really easy for stores to get these PDFs in the hands of their customers.
Chad, not too long ago, bought a game that is on the list of games that you can get digital copies, but the store mentioned nothing about it. That's why we were so surprised that I'd found that on the list. Trying to find a retailer that's actually doing this, such a great concept, but if the retailers aren't on board, or if they are and they're not pushing it, then they're losing out on sales. You're potentially losing sales too.
If they're not involved, in my mind, they're crazy for that fact, because here's a great way where they can add value while delivering that digital product in a non-competitive way. So, I mean, this is just something they can give their customers
without losing anything.
Exactly. Because, I mean, that's really what this whole new media thing is all about. It's not about, per se, traditional media is going utterly extinct, but it's about the fact that people want flexibility in terms of how they consume the things that they have purchased and being able to walk into a place. I mean, I'm a man who loves a physical book. I'll take a physical book over a PDF any day of the week, but I'll tell you straight up, if there's two stores and one of them's going to give me the PDF and the other one's just going to sit behind the counter with some fat beard arrogance and tell me why I'm stupid for wanting a PDF, I'll tell you which one I'm going to.
Preach it. Tell them. Yeah, that's exactly what we're shooting for. Bits and Mortar is us and Evil Hat that publish the Dresden Files and Spirit of the Century. Pelgrane Press from Trail of Cthulhu and Mongoose Publishing signed up recently, which is certainly our biggest member in terms of how much stuff they put out. There's a lot of publishers on board with it. So it's been very fun. And the more we can get the word out about it, the better.
Let me ask you about that from the other end. Let's say there's people listening to us that themselves are involved in a game company or looking to start one up. What do they have to do to join Bits and Mortar?
Well, basically, just send an email through the website. You know, there's instructions. In fact, if you go to the website, one of the big things on the top is how do I join? And basically, it's just get in touch with us and somebody from the group can kind of talk about what our philosophy is and what the ground rules are. And there aren't many, but for instance, it has to be a free PDF. You have to be willing to give a store the power to download your PDF and use it to whatever extent their conscience is going to allow. You've got to sort of sign on for the basic mission statement. It's not a huge hurdle to get through. I mean, we've tended to try to focus on publishers that were somewhat well established. You know, I mean, you need to have an actual publication. We've had a few people want to sign up because they had something in the works, but they hadn't actually published anything yet. You know, and we're not going to add a company if don't actually have something to send to a store.
It would make no sense to have the bit, but no mortar.
Right, yeah, or the other way around. Yeah, you know, and you have to be selling to retail, of course, is the other thing. So as long as you can kind of check those boxes, then it's not hard. You know, we didn't set it up to make it a really exclusive thing at all. We want to encourage publishers to participate because the more publishers participate, the more attention it's going to draw from gamers.
Right. Okay, and I'll be sure to provide a link to that site in the show notes so anyone who's driving around or whatever can check that out at their leisure.
Getting kind of away from like industry sort of things and everything we've been talking about for the past little bit here.
But it's so intrinsically fascinating to everybody.
Yes. To the people who have absolutely no interest in publishing anything ever.
Dude, I don't know. You'd be surprised.
Well, yeah. But. You know, actually, I don't ever plan on publishing anything really myself, but. I found pretty interesting.
It's fascinating to some of us, but we had to wake Chad up so he could ask some questions.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I was going to ask you, Shane, do you play role-playing games? Because I've actually talked to other people who write or publish or edit or in the industry, and they just don't play anymore. I guess it's kind of like working at McDonald's. You never want to eat another hamburger or french fries ever again sort of thing. But...
Well, I'll tell you, I hardly ever, I'm sad to say, play my own games. Mm-hmm. And that's not deliberate, but the game group that I'm in, they're a hard sell, just conceptually. People kind of like other kinds of stuff. So, but yeah, I have a weekly Wednesday night tabletop group, and we kind of bounce from campaign to campaign. Usually we sort of play one game for a couple of months and sort of play through a story arc in it, and then something shiny catches our attention, and we do that with another game.
What are you playing?
So familiar.
What are you playing right now?
Right now, I'm just wrapping up a game called Duty and Honor, which is a Napoleonic game where you're playing redcoats in Spain.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a very cool concept. It's been interesting because it's very much a 4G story kind of game. So it has a really specific structure to gameplay.
What do you mean by 4G story?
Yeah, oh boy, that's a can of worms. I guess what I mean is that its emphasis is much less on describing details of what happens, especially in action and combat, and more on giving you the resolution of who succeeds in a scene in a general sense, and then letting you kind of describe how it plays out after determining that, you know. So when two characters are contesting for something, they'll just say what skill they're using and then put down their cards, because it's a playing card based game, and whoever does better wins, and whoever wins gets to describe how it goes down. And, you know, there are wrinkles to it, but that's kind of the basic thing. And in a bigger picture, when you're building the adventures, you know, for the game, you build them in a way that's very kind of formally structured, you know, where you have a mission goal that you're describing, and then it encourages you as the GM to get the players involved to say, what kinds of stuff do you want to see happen in this adventure? And not all of it's going to be in there, but give me some ideas. And then you basically build a series of challenges that they're going to have to overcome as a group, leading up to sort of the final main challenge that they'll have to accomplish to get their way. And then basically you define stakes for it. So if they succeed at this mission, then they're going to get better at something. And if they fail at it, then they'll lose something, whether it's reputation or whatever, however you want to describe it. The rules are much more about building a story and building the sort of narrative elements than they are about how you hit and how much damage do you do. You know what
right.
I mean?
Right.
Well, you know, Shane, I was going to say, when you started talking, you sounded like a pretty straight-laced guy, but after your description of that, now I'm picturing you with longer hair and smoking pot and riding like a bus.
Yeah, for some reason.
As you whip out your funky card game.
For some reason, Chris thinks that people who play enjoyable, good games that are about story narrative are hippies instead of, you know, the intellectual elite like we are.
I wanted to ask you in relation to that, though. I mean, obviously, you're doing that because you get some definite satisfaction out of it, but...
Wait, are we talking about games or weed?
Well, the bus, actually. Driving around the Volkswagen bus. But is that your primary motivator when it comes to really... what you really get out of games? You know, for a lot of people, it is. It's just, I want to just roll dice and roll dice and then roll some more dice after I'm done rolling those dice. And, you know, and others do like that nice story feel to it. I mean, is that your primary motivator? Are you really what you get off on, basically?
No, it's not. And you know, it's interesting, Duty and Honor. What I was going to say is that it's kind of a departure for my group, in fact, because usually we tend to be much more interested in the traditional approach to role-playing games. But there are a couple of us in the group who have been really heavily exposed to the indie side of things. But even so, we both tend to kind of prefer more traditional kind of simulation-y games. And so Duty and Honor has actually been kind of a departure. And it was inspired by, Duty and Honor wasn't, but our playing of it was inspired by playing a few games of Fiasco a few months ago at Gen Con and right after. That went, you know, surprisingly well, considering what a weird kind of hippie non-RPG RPG it is. So Duty and Honor, we wanted to give it a shot because it has sort of some similar conceptual ideas behind it. But that kind of structure where the focus is on building the story and then you work out the details after the fact in a way is, you know, it's a very different experience than traditional RPG where you're playing out the details and then you find out the story as it evolves from that.
I'm actually stuck on a completely different point on that, which is you said you're playing Redcoats in Spain during the Napoleonic Age.
Yeah, the Peninsular War.
Right, yeah, I know, but goodness gracious, that is very historically specific.
Mm-hmm.
How much reading did it take to actually be able to run and play this game and to get it right?
Yeah, for me, I went crazy reading and researching it. I mean, it helps because I do that anyway. But anytime I'm starting on a game, especially a historical game, I tend to just go nuts with the research. So yeah, I've got a stack of books 2 feet high that I've kind of accumulated over the last few months planning this. And also, I was a Napoleonic buff long before we decided to play the game. I've been pushing them to try to run this game for a couple of years now. So yeah, I kind of went whole hog. And it's kind of funny because the designer, I think if I remember right, I've had people comment either, I don't know if it was in person or on one of the message boards, about, you know, the amount of detail, because I put all that in the AP, mm-hmm. in the actual play reports. to kind of give a lot of context for what the characters are doing and where they are and why, you know, and make it into a fun read. And I've had a lot of people say stuff like, you know, that looks really, really well researched and detailed. How much did you have to prepare for that? And I prepared an awful lot, but the designer, he kind of downplays that deliberately to tell people, you know what, you don't need to be scared. You don't have to do like that guy, you know, and, you know, it's really easy to run if you've basically watched some Sharp movies,
I was gonna say,
know,
the Sharps
and want to just go with it. You can do it that way, or you can be an obsessive idiot like me and read like crazy, you know, and make it a really detailed, deep historical kind of exploration of what society was like and what the social classes, you know, what their interactions were like in that era.
So is this like a passive aggressive thing where you're trying to drive people away from his games?
Oh, I sound like a real a-hole, don't I? No, not at all. My point there was not to say, you know, don't play it because you have to do the research. You really don't have to do the research.
Just, that's how much you love it.
Well, I dig that kind of thing. So I went crazy and I, you know, it had everything it needed to let me do that.
And like you said, too, that there's a, well, actually, I'll say it's an okay book series, but I think an even better British BBC like miniseries called the Sharp series. And it is about characters who were like sharpshooters, although they were led by a guy named Sharp, in the Peninsular War. The books and the movie can play out easily like a role-playing game, because it's about a small elite force who's doing, well, small elite things in this great big setting of a war. It gives a lot of culture, and it gives a lot of the history in an entertaining format. So I think, you just send a couple of those. If your players are a little scared of that, saying, oh, I don't know anything about this, you know, here, watch this and this, 2 hours out of your life, you'll be fine, and it'll be entertaining.
Yeah, that's kind of what we did. In fact, I didn't actually send them any movies, but part of my preparation for the game was putting together some materials at the beginning that I could make available to the players. And more importantly, I wanted to get straight in my head what I wanted the players to learn the first time we sat down, so that they could sort of play the setting and get the most out of it. You know, I mean, it's entirely possible to play it from the perspective of a modern day dude sitting at a game table, the way that we usually do with D&D characters or whatever we're playing. But because the game has such a rich setting, you know, I wanted to really make the most of that. And so first time we sat down to play it, I spent a good bit of the session just sort of talking to the players about the setting and about the history of it and about what makes the characters tick, you know, and social class is a huge, huge issue in that in that era. So I talked a lot about that. And the game itself is built, by the way, so that you're not going to suffer if you play only a lowly private, you know, and another player is playing the captain of the company. It's built very, very specifically to make sure that every player character gets moments to shine, and the only real difference is what kind of stuff are you involved in, you know. So if you want to play a character that's doing all kinds of gentlemanly things, and you know, then play the captain. And if you want to play a guy that's sneaking around and stealing and trying to avoid the lash, you know, then play a grimy private.
Well, is this a released game system, or is this a homebrew?
No, it's published. It's self-published by Neil Gow, whose company is Omnihedron Games over in England. And so he put this out a couple of years ago, and then he followed it with a couple of supplements. And there's a variant game, or sort of a sequel, called Beat to Quarters, which is the same thing, but in the Royal Navy. So if you want to play.
So it goes from Sharps in the Peninsular War to Master and Commander.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Again, those are wonderful books, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Patrick O'Brien is my favorite author, bar none.
I think that Bernard Cornwell, his Sharps books, I tried to read them. They're a bit too pulp actiony, even though he does a whole lot of research. They're very, very accurate for historical fiction.
They have sort of a boy's own adventure kind of a feel.
Right.
To, you know what
right.
I mean? You know, so they're fun, but yeah, the Sharp books, they're fun, but they certainly yeah. don't just hit me in my gut like the Aubrey and
love Master Games.
You know, it's a fun system, and it's been an interesting kind of experiment. Before I ran Duty and Honor, the last game that I ran for the group was Aces and Eights, which is 360 degrees different. Well, that'd be the same, wouldn't it? So 180 degrees. Yeah. You know, I mean, where Aces and Eights is very much about really, really detailed character stats and really detailed resolution of action scenes down to literally the tenth of the second at a time. And so it's like the dead opposite tone of game, you know. But, you know, I've run that really successfully, you know, in two different mini campaigns, and they're looking forward to starting up a third one in a few months here. So I love kind of seeing the different ways that we can do this kind of thing.
So you talked about your own personal passion here for the historical research and this historical fiction. And I'm curious, how, if at all, does this impact the games that you yourself create for publication?
A lot. Monsters and Other Childish Things, of course, is not a historical game. You know, it's much more about, you know...
It's autobiographical.
He's crazy.
Maybe a monster hides in his eyes.
But I mean, we started with Godlike, you know, which right. is... War II. And it's not just World War II, but it's really, really deeply researched alternate history.
You can see it in that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that book was done before we started Arc Dream, and I wasn't involved in creating Godlike. I kind of came in after the fact because Dennis and I had worked together before on other projects with Pagan Publishing. But we wouldn't have started that if I didn't completely fall in love with what he had done with Godlike. And that kind of informed a lot of the stuff that we've done since then. I mean, Wild Talents has its own alternate history built into the big core book, which you can take or leave depending, you know, whatever you want to do when you're running your own game. But we provided a sort of historical timeline within the world of Godlike, but starting at the end of World War II and taking it up to more or less the present day, and sort of exploring, you know, how the world kind of evolves in that setting. And you know, we have a Wild Talents book called This Favored Land, which is set in the U.S. Civil War. And so that one, it's sort of a different approach because it's not really an alternate history, because the whole point of that is that there are a lot of elements in the setting that are striving to keep the existence of the superhuman stuff under the table and secret. And so it's entirely possible for the players to do stuff that'll change the course of history. But as written, it starts off kind of assuming that it's really close to how it actually happened, and that all this crazy superhero stuff that's there was not seen or was swept under the rug or whatever. And we have another book called The Kerberos Club, which is Wild Talents, which is set in Victorian England, Victorian London mainly. That's one that takes the opposite tact again, where it sort of starts off with history kind of hewing fairly closely to reality. And then the strangeness, as it's called, the superhuman stuff, becomes kind of more and more overt as the years go by, until, you know, the world has kind of gone off the rails in this sort of big steampunk craziness by the end of the century. We have a book called Progenitor, which starts in 1968. And the whole idea there is that basically at that point in 67, this one woman develops superpowers. You know, there's a crazy meteor accident, and she gets these insanely powerful abilities. She's the only one that's ever had anything like this in the world. But by using them, she transfers some of that energy to other people. They do the same in turn. And so people kind of catch superpowers from each other as they're being used. And so the whole book is kind of, it's very much about how does the world change based on the characters that are built into the setting and what they do. And here are a whole lot of tools for you as the gamers to determine how that setting is going to change based on what your players do in it. So, the historical stuff is it's front and center with just about everything that we do. Even the horror, we work with Pagan to do Delta Green, which is a modern day Call of Cthulhu setting. And it's modern day, but it's really heavily informed by everything that's come before. You know, we're history nuts, you know, we're history buffs. Mm-hmm. So we're fascinated by the way that civilization shapes itself and reacts to things.
Has it always been that way for you, even before you really got into history? I mean, when you started RPGs, when did you actually start playing RPGs?
August 1979.
Do you have the date, the time? You can get that detailed about it.
I remember because it was me and a friend of mine were in fifth grade, and basically he heard some kids talking about this weird game. And, you know, when he started talking about it, I kind of envisioned a board game, you know, because they were talking about miniatures. And so when we went and got a copy of the D&D basic set and cracked it open and started playing and just completely became obsessed with it and fell in love.
Your transference from there to getting into history, was that, did that happen pretty quick? And then, you know, were you able to either homebrew rules or find the games right away to kind of, you know, satisfy that itch?
No, it happened pretty gradually. The attention to the historical stuff in games, you know, when I was young, I mean, we played D&D for a while, and then we kind of moved on to RuneQuest and Call of Cthulhu, and so with RuneQuest, it was like RuneQuest Third Edition, which was built ostensibly in sort of a fantasy version of medieval Europe. But even there, we weren't really paying too much attention to a really close historical setting. We just kind of added in as we, you know, that we thought would be fun. So yeah, it wasn't until a good bit later that I started really delving into wanting to do a lot more of the historical games, you know, as a thing. I benefit from the fact that, you know, right now I'm in a game group that is also primarily history buffs, you know, so I have kind of a built-in audience that's willing to do that kind of thing.
You know, and tying that back in, I guess, to part of the original topic that we were talking about, have you found that, you know, with the games that have that historical aspect to it, does that get a little bit easier when it comes to describing things?
Sometimes, yeah. You know, with Godlike, people know what World War II was like, more or less. So you can tell them, you know, it's like that, but it's like the really dangerous stuff that you've seen for that. You know, it's Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan, not John Wayne movies. And it's that plus weird superpowers. That usually does the trick, you know, at least as far as conveying a sense of what the game's about. You know, that doesn't tell you how it plays at all, because you could have any game, any set of rules that fit the setting, and they'll all play in really different ways. And so the strength of Godlike, for instance, is always that its rules kind of lended themselves to really frenetic, dangerous action that made you afraid to have your character leave the ditch. There are other rules engines that would have played a lot more, a lot differently and wouldn't have been as effective, I think, at that setting, because we very much wanted it to be a scary, dangerous game, not an over-the-top, pulpy, heroic game. But because basically just as designers and as writers, the stuff that we tend to respond to is not really characters being heroic because of how much heroic power they have, as characters who find out they're heroic by the fact that they're, you know, willing to get killed doing things on behalf of other people. And so Godlike is all about that. And Call of Cthulhu is all about that, you know, which is why we've always done Call of Cthulhu. And you know, that sort of informed the whole idea behind Delta Green and The Unspeakable Oath, now that we're publishing that again as well.
So what do you guys have coming up? What's on the horizon here for Arc Dream?
We've just released a Godlike campaign book called Black Devil's Brigade, which is actually the first full-length campaign that we ever did for Godlike, a huge 260-something pages, I don't remember, that sort of tracks this one particular commando unit through the battle for Italy. And it's really cool. We've been working on it for a while, and it's been really fun to see it take shape. And the unit that it's about is half the charm, because it was a real unit in the war, and they became really infamous within certain circles. It was called the 1st Special Service Force, and it was this sort of joint Canadian-American regiment that was trained, they received airborne training, and they were all mountaineers. You know, they recruited park rangers and mountain climbers and people that, you know, that knew how to get around in the wild so that they could send them on missions, you know, into Norway, climbing up and attacking reactors and all these inaccessible places. And basically, they never got used for any of that. You know, they kind of developed and they received really intensive training and really quickly got sent into Italy, where they occasionally sort of scaled mountains that everybody, including the Germans, thought were impossible to scale and therefore were inaccessible, you know, and doing these commando raids or just fighting on the front lines, where they kind of suffered heavily because, like a lot of elite units, they were really well trained and didn't have the right weaponry for that kind of combat. But they got most famous for the Anzio battles, which were sort of near this beachhead, and it became this kind of fixed thing where there were all these German gun emplacements and ditches and machine gun nests, and then the Americans were over here, and it was just static for a while. Nobody really got anywhere. But what the forcemen did was they would go out at night, really late at night, and because they were really good at stealth, you know, their whole raison d'etre was sneaking through the woods, you know, so they were creepy, and they would sneak out to these German positions and just bare hands and knives murder everybody there and leave these little stickers behind that had a picture of a little devil on it and a thing that said, "The worst is yet to come" in German. And then they would leave and not take the position or anything. They would just go back to the lines, and then others, you know, Germans would come to see what happened to Fritz, and, you know, and oh my God. so the Germans started calling them the Black Devils, and that's how they got the name. So it's a really, you know, for a history buff that's also a military history buff, they're a great read. So they made perfect kind of unit to develop as player characters in the godlike setting. So that's our current brand new thing that's out there. And it started showing up at people's houses just this week, which has been lots of fun. And we've already heard lots of people say they're about to start campaigns. Last year, we had the new Delta Green Book Targets of Opportunity, and that'll be in a paperback at Gen Con, we hope. And we're working on a Fate edition of the Kerberos Club, which is the Victorian Wild Talents setting. We've experimented with adapting that setting to a couple of different game lines. So we have a Savage Worlds edition of the Kerberos Club that we put out last year, and then we're going to release the Fate edition in a few months now. And it'll be kind of, I'll be curious to sort of see what the response is. I'm fairly hopeful, because the Kerberos Club kind of lends itself as a setting to the kinds of stuff that Fate does really well. And then we're publishing the quarterly Call of Cthulhu magazine, The Unspeakable Oath, which started 20 years ago and ran off and on for about 7 years, and then took a break, and then had another issue, and then took a break for 10 years before we relaunched it a few months ago. So I went back and got a lot of the guys back aboard that were involved with it back when it was first around. And, you know, everybody was saying it was the best thing for Call of Cthulhu gaming ever made, and brought in a lot of new writers, you know, like Greg Stoltze, that works with us a lot, and Kenneth Height, who works with us a lot, you know, and then a lot of guys that haven't been published as extensively, but have really cool ideas that we can put in the magazine. So that's really exciting and really fun, because that magazine is the property that got me involved in the gaming industry to begin with. So it's been really, really a joy to see that back alive.
Awesome. Well, Shane, I want to thank you very much for joining us and hanging out with us here on the show.
Yeah, thanks, man.
And
no, you bet.
And I will, of course, provide links to a variety of the things mentioned, including to Arc Dream's website itself and the show notes for anyone who wants to check those out. And for anyone that's curious to hear an actual play of Monsters and Other Childish Things, which includes both Ross Payton from RPPR and also our very own Chad, I believe that will be going up here pretty soon. And I'll probably provide a link to that in the show notes, not this episode, but our next regular episode, which will be 227.
No guarantees on the sound quality on that one. It was a little loud down there, yeah. But we had a really, really good time.
If you want to dig through the archives, there's an actual play with me doing Wild Talents last year.
Nice.
At Fear the Con.
Oh, nice.
I have to say that I was kind of shooting the dice, so to speak, on Monsters and Other Childish Things. I wasn't too sure about it because, you know, it's just like, well, you know, you play a kid and then you play a monster. Or do you play them both? What do you do with that once you got it? And I wasn't quite seeing the possibilities of it. But Wayne was actually talking up Ross and his GMing ability, and so I decided, yeah, what the hell, I'll give it a shot. It seems interesting enough, and I loved it. I absolutely love Monsters and Other Childish Things. I want to get it. I want to run it for these guys. I want to play it.
I already own it.
Well, then, what are you doing with it? Give me your copy. You're not running it.
I brought it from Shane himself at Gen Con last year. So, yes, nice. I have a copy of Monsters and Other Childish Things.
Well, can I borrow your copy of Monsters?
Yes, you may borrow my copy.
Thank you.
Just remind me before you leave, and I will give it to
you. And I would like for us to try the godlike game setting. Just sitting here listening to this.
And guess what I own?
Awesome, because that and also the Victorian setting. I only played a little bit in Victorian setting, but I find it kind of cool.
You just like it because it's so decadent.
Yes, exactly. I love it. So to go from the decadence to the grittiness of the World War II, like you're saying,
children.
Some of my favorite things are the
right oh my along. God, we yeah, could no, play no. this whole overarching campaign with all like a generational family where it's this decadent Victorian, and then it goes into this, you know, superpower World War II, and then it's their great 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 grandchildren.
Yes. Okay.
With possessed by monsters.
All right, you've convinced me. I'll roll up Blackadder. Okay.
Actions they did coalesced a monster.
Yes.
Which will watch over child of future generation.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. It's like the Victorian guys summon this Cthulhu monster, which destroys them, but it infects their family line, which empowers them for World War II,
we're all learning here on this show. I bet you did not realize that Arc Dream has a Palladium Megaverse.
It's all coming clear.
We're here to connect.
Maybe a little too clear.
All right. Well, thank you again, Shay. And as for the rest of you guys, thank you very much for tuning in. We've enjoyed this one, and we look forward to catching you all in the next one. Once again, we'll be providing our final round of links and last thoughts on Fear the Con 4 before we move on to other things.
Other childish things?
Other childish things.
Okay.
So you guys have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.